Good morning. That's the title of my talk that, as it appeared in the program, I'm not responsible for it, but I duly repeated it, and I assume that the context is that of this overall meeting, and certainly having heard a lot of excellent talks, presentations, lectures, my choice of material is somewhat affected, so I hope it's in the context. Until somewhere mid-1970s, basically the only thing that people worried about, well, not the only thing, but was sort of global seismologists essentially were trying to improve the average Earth model. During 1970s, there were a very large number of new data that came in, particularly the normal mode data, which allowed us to constrain the density distribution inside the Earth and refine many other features. So PREM, this is not a slide that was made, this is now exactly 25 years. And it still remains, with some exceptions, a valid model. What you want to see here is this region on which we are concentrating of a very rapid increase and clear complexities in this very steep increase in velocities as well as in density, and that's obviously still actually remains a question of research, and we have one of our research groups that's focusing on the explanation for this rapid gradient and overall mineralogy of this region. So the upper mantle is the place where most things happen, and this is the PREM in the upper mantle. Notice that the scale for VP is different from that for VS and rho density. And you have these jumps which vary in size and vary in depth. Sometime in mid-80s, the seismic tomography, global tomography, became widely accepted as a tool to study the Earth's interior. And essentially, we went within a very short time from the surface all the way to the inner core. The inner core is not in a context, the rest of it is, and you can see that the orange and blue and yellows are slow velocity anomalies with respect to the average Earth, and blue are fast. So we can actually now look at heterogeneity. Of course, we don't know whether it's caused by temperature or by composition, and people trying to figure it out, and it probably will take much more data. In late 90s, people were fascinated by pictures like this, where you actually had a map of P velocity anomalies at 1300 kilometer depth, and very razor thin feature here, which has been associated with the Farallon slab, and more diffuse feature here, and which was also associated with the Thetis subduction. The thing that convinced everybody that this must be right is that pretty much the same, or at least very similar, picture has been obtained from the S-wave tomography, although this region is even more diffuse and broad. I think that figures that were shown most often, and may be somewhere near whoever keeps record on figures shown, is this slice through US of what's called the Farallon slab, essentially a remainder of subduction, past subduction for, I'm not quite sure how many millions of years. You can see that there are some differences. For example, this is the S image, this is the P image, and this area here looks different than here. So they are not totally. Nevertheless, it convinced people that the slabs go into the lower mantle, that I guess they become thousands of kilometers thick, or at least this is 1,000 kilometers somewhere. But nevertheless, that convinced a lot of people, including geodynamicists always liked this idea of whole mantle convection, but even geochemists became convinced. And so it really question of the layered convection sort of was put on a back burner, and essentially talking about layer convection as one of the very famous geochemists told me was like talking about, forgot now about what it was, but something extremely reactionary. So, but what do these great models tell us about transition zone? And this is the picture at 550 kilometer depth, taken from the model of Grant, which is the S model, and van der Hulst. And as you can see, they basically, it's a fairly large scale. This is plus minus 2%. And there are some hints of blue here. But there's very little, if nothing, in a model of Grant. So they basically don't tell us anything about transition zone. And the reason is that they were constructed using teleseismic travel times, and they are not sensitive to the upper mantle structure. So we clearly have to do something different. And indeed, the models that in which derivations are either surface wave data and or wavefront data were used do show a very distinct structure. There's five different models, and all show high velocities in the Western Pacific as well as under South America. That feature repeats. It's weaker in some models than in others, but they are fairly similar pictures. So clearly there is a signal in the transition zone, and from its location, it has been inferred that it probably has something to do with subduction, because this is where the subduction zones are. So we are going back a little bit, and one of the reasons why the layered convection was thought of as the answer in the early days of plate tectonics was that people could see that there were earthquakes that essentially, well, for one thing, earthquakes' absolute limit is 700 kilometers. There hasn't been well-documented earthquake that occurred below 700 kilometer depth. I guess the record is something like 697. Here you have, these are compression axes from the CMT catalog. So the axis of compression, the location is that dot, and the axis of compression is indicated here by this long line. And you can see that over a distance of about 500 kilometers, there are something like, well, in this case, 13 earthquakes, except for this one, all occurring in at a depth between 600 and 700 kilometers. Their mechanism in terms of orientation of the axis varies, and it seems to be vertical in the west and horizontal in the east. That's another sort of problem with trying to explain this. The overall reasons for which deep earthquakes occur still remains. But anyway, so it seemed like there was a boundary that things stopped at. And that's been seen in other places. So for example, this is a cross-section by the central Tonga-Kermadec region. And you can see the P-axis here is a Benioff zone. They more or less follow what they're supposed to follow, that is to be down dip compression. But then something happens here when things hit about 600 kilometers. At least part of the plate seems to deviate. are the mechanisms. It goes horizontal. The mechanisms are actually perpendicular to those here. On the other hand, we have one super deep and very large earthquake at 700 kilometers. So it's not really clear what happens here. We have another cross section, which is in Izu, Benin. And here you have the isolated earthquake some 200 kilometers away from other earthquakes. There are two peculiar things about it. One is that this earthquake occurs at 550 kilometers. So we have another 100 to 150 kilometers left here. And also you can see that the end here of this main subduction zone, the P vectors tend to become horizontal. So as if the plate was deviating here, but actually bottoming out at some depth above 600 kilometers. And this is one of the regions where, as you will see later, there are strong anomalies, and it could be that the bottom of the transition zone is already full of stuff and that thing cannot go any deeper. And this was regions like this, why early in the plate tectonics, the cartoons, this is a very famous one from the paper, 1968 paper by Isaacs, Oliver, and Sykes, showing sort of the idea of the plate tectonics. But if you look at these arrows here, the material subducted in some way, which is not very clear, gets recirculated, and you essentially have a convection limited to the upper mantle. So what we want to do is now to look at the velocities in a transition zone. I already showed you some models. The trick is to use as many data, as Guy said, as possible. In the nicely behaving regions, such as lower mantle, you have a gradual increase in velocities. And the waves that are generated, the waves propagate in such a medium in a very orderly fashion. The rays that start steeper go farther, and you don't actually have any anomalies here. You have a nice, smooth travel time curve. You have slowness that decreases with distance. So these are good observations, but they can be made, and this is why a lot of papers uses only teleseismic times, that is, for rays that bottomed below one of these complexities. So here is example of a rapid velocity increase, such as you would have in a transition zone. What it causes is that the rays deviate, and essentially you have a loop here where some of the arrivals come as a later arrivals, and these loops in general are very difficult to decipher exactly, especially near the corners. And unless you do this, you will not get the right velocity distribution. So for example here, ray parameter as a function of distance decreases, but it has this retrograde path, and this particular part is very difficult to decipher. Even bigger problems are low velocity zones, which essentially delineate a region in which rays cannot bottom. And in this case, you have a shadow zone. You essentially have a gap in your data. So all these things, and if you remember, there are several such jumps in a transition zone, and essentially you have these multiple loops. And for example, the rays that bottom in a transition zone between 400 and 650 kilometers essentially are, except for very short distance range, all secondary arrivals. So it's difficult to study transition zone using arrival times of body waves. The situation is a little bit better with surface waves at the very long periods, which overlaps with the free oscillation with a range of frequency in which free oscillations are studied. essentially the 350-second ready wave has the maximum sensitivity at somewhere 650 kilometers. So clearly, ready waves, if you can get to long enough periods, are very good for studying the transition zone. Love waves, a little bit less so. The maximum sensitivity is always near the surface. And here, even at 350 kilometers, the sensitivity is only about 1/4 or 1/5 of that near the surface. Nevertheless, you can still pick up the signal. You can measure differential travel times. That's done on waveforms. And for example, you can cross-correlate SS with the S signal. And in this way, by the delay, you can measure the differential travel time. The nice thing about it is that the effect of the source and receiver is lessened by the similarity of the rays just under those. There are also a large data set of SCS waves reflected from the Kármán-Tú boundary minus S, and which can be measured this way. But actually, the greatest trove of data are the seismograms themselves. Here is an earthquake in Colombia, recorded at Palisades. And here I have a various, these are actually seismograms. This is vertical, this is horizontal. And you can see that there is a lot of wiggles here, and they have these different labels which correspond to the ray paths. So essentially, one seismogram gives you a sample of the medium at different depth along the same great circle. So it would be very nice to be able to use those, and it's possible through some theoretical developments. There are some approximations, there are some better theories than others, but the idea is that you essentially use the entire waveform, and here a record of an earthquake is compared to the synthetic calculated for Pran. And if you get here to this G3, you can see that they are pretty severely out of phase, and G4 is actually completely out of phase. But by introducing 3D structure, you can remove this, and it's really this difference between these seismograms tells you how to modify the model so that there would be actually good agreement between the seismic observed and synthetic seismogram. You can see that here there is other energy than just fundamental mode. These are love waves, the wave groups, but there are overtones in this as well, which provide you additional information. You can also try to explain parts of seismograms that consist of body waves. Here you can see the time scale is much more expanded in comparison to this. And up to a certain point, Pram predicts things well, but after that, these observed lines and those predicted by the model diverge significantly. But by constructing a 3D Earth model and using these differences as input, you can actually bring traces into alignment. So this is one of the Earth models that actually I will be talking about. By combining diverse set of data, it's possible to establish a fairly uniform resolution along the full range depth. These are spline numbers. This is essentially Kármán-Tú, this is MOHO. This is Kármán-Tú boundary. This is 660 kilometer discontinuity. And you can see that by using this group of data here represents this waveform data, that they actually fill in this important part. So they are very important in the transition zone. Here you have these differential and absolute travel times, which give you good control over the lower mantle structure. So essentially, Grant would have used only data, well, it's a little bit more complicated than this, but SSS, so just this group of data. So he really would not have much control over the upper mantle. And this is sort of depth. This is moho, because the radial variations in a model are expressed by cubic splines, unevenly distributed. So this is moho. Spline number 14 corresponds to moho, or spline number 8 corresponds to the 660 kilometer discontinuity. Spline number 1 corresponds to Kármán-Tú boundary. So it's sort of depth, but what these are is actually plots of the maximum diagonal element in the inner product matrix, which essentially shows you which data set is most sensitive to which depth. So the idea is to use data set that spans the complete set of depths that you want to represent in the model. And it's a little bit problem with this. So we use such a data set and we obtained a model, two models actually. One continuous, where the spline representation across the 660 kilometers was continuous, and one discontinuous. This is a continuous one, and it essentially has three or four, depends how you count, strong features, very characteristic. That doesn't change much with the model as long as you use reasonably complete data set. Right at the top of the model, we have a thermal boundary layer, and its maximum energy at degree 5. So it's somewhere here. And that sort of represents distribution of cratons and mid-ocean ridges. But then you have a secondary, as you go down, you lose a little bit of the amplitude, and then you pick it up in a transition zone. And actually here, the dominant degree is degree 2. Then you enter into the lower mantle, and all of a sudden things change and remain pretty much the same down to about more than 2,000 kilometer depth. And this spectrum sort of tends to be more white than in the other parts. And then again, a very strange thing happens. The spectrum becomes, there is more signal in the lowermost mantle, and the spectrum also is very red. If we allow for discontinuity at 650, there is sort of a schizophrenic thing, because we still use Prem model as a starting model, and it has a discontinuity at 670, sort of been corrected recently, I guess. But so if you allow the model to be discontinuous across 670, then this is the velocity 20 kilometers above the discontinuity, and you see the strong degree 2 signal. And this is below, and it looks completely different. Also, it's much weaker, and it has much more short-term features. What you have here is a comparison of the power spectra just above and just below the discontinuity. You can see that they're very dissimilar, that you lose all this low, very low, very long wavelengths signal as you come across the discontinuity. So the first order observation is that things change, that they are very different in transition zone and just below it. We have made a test where we put some anomalies just below. This is the first spline below the discontinuity, then run all the forward problem data through this, and then try to recover it. And if we use continuous splines, obviously the thing spills across the discontinuity. If you allow for the discontinuity, then you essentially have very little. There's certain amount of signal, but most of it is properly represented. So we think actually that In some sense, the data set prefers the split model. If we try the same thing at other depth, and in this particular case, the 400 kilometer discontinuity, and we allow for discontinuous splines at 400, then we get a map above and below the discontinuity, and they look extremely similar. If you look at their power spectra, they are just about the same. So clearly, the 400 and 650 kilometer discontinuities are quite different in terms of their impact on seismic power spectrum. We also tried, because it was proposed that there is some discontinuity, well, this is the 400, but that there is something at 1,000 kilometers and also at 1,800 kilometers. And even though these pictures above and below are not exactly the same, the power spectrum is. So there is no indication of a impediment in flow. The system works in the same way, more or less, above and below the discontinuity. One way to assess whether things are continuous or not is to calculate a radial correlation function. There is a paper by Jordan and others which says, well, this would be a discriminant to show whether, for example, things change abruptly across the discontinuity. So here we have this, and the maximum is always on this counter diagonal, because you essentially compare the models itself at this depth. At other depths, you compare and calculate cross-correlation coefficients between maps at some fixed depth and then varying depths, and that sort of would give you a raw at some particular chosen depth. So here, essentially the width of this red region is as if how good is your resolution at a given depth. So in these S362 models, we change the spline separation between upper and lower mantle, but this particular, the C0 model, is continuous, and you actually don't see anything dramatic as you cross the discontinuity. On the other hand, in a discontinuous model, you have this sharp break. Yet both models fit the data nearly equally well, and essentially on the basis of data fit, they could not be distinguished. So therefore, you cannot use the fact that there is no discontinuity in radial correlation function, because if you put continuous model, there is limited radial resolution, and this matrix will always have a certain width. It turns out that other models predict this effect as well. So now we picked one row in this radial correlation function, and in case of the discontinuous model, you essentially, the fixed depth is at 540 kilometers, so the cross-correlation coefficient is always one there. Here we go across 650, and we get a sudden drop nearly to zero. So it's very little correlation between structure in the transition zone and below it. But if we look at some other models, which are continuous in their representation, they essentially represent a very rapid decrease. This is a Berkeley model, this is Caltech model. So this is a Scripps model, which actually doesn't have this feature, but apparently newer Scripps models do. So there is indication also in other models that the spectral characteristics of the structure, which is sort of something that in a very general way expresses the characteristic of the system, that there is a rapid change, either abrupt change at 670 or 50, or very gradual, but this gradual thing, not very gradual, very rapid change, but over a certain range of depths, and that difference is caused simply by the ways of representation of the model. If we look what happens in the regions that are subduction zones, so we take a box one and we actually calculate in within this box the RMS root mean square, the power, overall power up to degree 12, I guess, in that yellow stripe. And this is the our model, this is Berkeley, this is Caltech, this was another family of our models. And you can see that the power goes up in the transition zone. And this is pretty much true for all the other subduction zone regions. So there is an indication in more than just one model that the power and generally character of the model changes is very distinct in the transition zone, distinct from other. So that's the part in which we just describe the lateral variations in velocities, and the impression there is, or the result is, that there are these large high velocity structures, quite wide, associated with or located where there are subduction zones. The other thing that we can look at is the topography of discontinuities, and Ann Sheehan spoke about it a little bit from the standpoint of using the converted phases, but we can also use other phases, and in some way they have certain advantages, because the converted phases you can do only underneath the stations, and there's very few stations in the oceans, and oceanic stations are anomalous anyway. So what has been identified as a good set of measurements is the precursors to SS, which is sort of once reflected S wave. This is called bounce point. And in addition to very large refraction, because there's reflection coefficient of one, these are transverse, this transverse component, SIH waves. You have something that if you have a discontinuity, will be reflected from this discontinuity, and you can measure this time, and for a particular distance, it can be converted into depth D of the phase. Of course, the paths are a little bit different. This is the range in which the observations are good, from 100 to about 160 degrees. And obviously these travel times will be a little bit different, essentially a move-out correction. The problem with this is that you essentially have to account for the laterally varying structure in this region. So this method could not be used until we have got to a satisfactory point in our mapping of the velocities in a upper mantle, but that eventually happened. This is how it actually works. This is observed seismogram, this is synthetic. You usually don't see these things, these reflections in a synthetic, but this was particularly a good seismogram. And so you see the S wave, then you see some influx of energy. It's good to work with synthetics because they roughly tell you where things are. And so this corresponds to the reflection from 670, this from 400, and actually you can see that this one, the observed one, comes a little bit later than predicted by Prem, and then this comes a little bit earlier, which essentially means that the transition zone thickness is probably not what Prem predicts, and it turns out to be true. The first global study was by Shearer and Masters, and in 1992, and they used the SS signal to map things. Here they had a profile, because actually it turns out that there was quite a few measurements there. This is the distribution of earthquakes in this region, and here you see this is on a fairly large scale, that there is a depression in this discontinuity. And here this is depression expanded, and essentially from about the 40 degrees to about 15 or even less, you have this deep depression which goes some 20 or 30 kilometers deeper than, well, whatever the normal is, but somewhere here. So the indication from this is that there are fairly large scale, both in terms of the depth, actual depth, and width in topography. Could you bring some water? One of the issues with such a long path that I used is that they have a fairly large Fresnel zone. So the first Fresnel zone is counted from more or less where the constructive interference of scattered waves stops. So these are about 20-second period waves, so we look where this is the nominal reflection point, but SS phase is not a minimum travel time path. So actually, if you deviate towards either receiver or source, you get slightly faster arrival times. If you deviate sidewise, you get delayed arrival times. But this is the area within which this saddle-like feature, within which you are within one quarter of the period, and essentially you could say that probably this ray will give us an average over something like 5 degree radius, or maybe a little bit more if you count these spoky ends. The scale, I'm sorry, the scale is, this is scale is in degrees, this is seconds. So so that's the area of the Ferris Fresnel zone. The other thing that this brings about is that we really, using this method, cannot resolve variations in velocity such as in a slab, which would be the velocities would be bent upward in the 400 kilometer discontinuity, and here downward. What we see is very broad average, and if this effect only existed, you would see probably a couple of kilometers change in the relief, which means that this will be well below the noise level. So these things that we see actually must be fairly large. So this is actually the coverage with rays, and each dot here represents a reflection point with the SS minus SDS precursor. So they are either from 220, 410, 520 with a question mark, because it's sort of elusive discontinuity, in 650 kilometers. So there's 21,000 points. The density is not uniform, but essentially in each part of the world, maybe except here, you have enough data to form a reliable average. The data are stacked using data from all the points within a 10 degree radius circle. So in some cases there were several hundred seismograms in one such circle, sometimes there would be only one. We essentially considered reliable only points at which we had something like 50 reflections. So you essentially have to stack and build up the signal in order to overcome the low signal noise ratio. So this is various topographies obtained for the 660 kilometers. This is paper by Gu et al. In 1998. And it shows, so this is now how these averages work. They are shown by the triangles, either blue or red. Blue is early, or, well, it's a depression. Red is elevated discontinuity. And you can see that even though they differ in details, that they are actually very similar, and that their spectra, which are shown here, have the same character. So we essentially can say that within some reasonable error that these are reproducible results, and indeed we have this large scale changes in sort of plus minus 20 kilometer and the wavelengths of up to several thousand kilometers. Now what here we compare is the variations in 660 topography obtained in our study, transition zone, the 410 kilometer, notice that it's much smaller than this, and then transition zone thickness, which could be obtained by simply subtracting one from the other, but actually here it was measured by in an independent way by essentially measuring the delay between the two precursors such that the waves did not penetrate into the very heterogeneous upper mantle. So that essentially what it shows is that the transition zone thickness is mostly dictated by the topography on 660 kilometer discontinuity. The other striking thing about this transition zone topography is that it's extremely well correlated with the velocity perturbation. So essentially where you have these large positive velocity anomalies, you also have downward depressions. So from this, the conclusion is that essentially these are two related events, and probably, I mean, the only thing I can think of is that they have heavier, faster, presumably cooler material, which in addition to having these higher velocities, has also higher density and therefore impinges on the boundary and essentially deflects it as a membrane. There's sort of open question in my mind whether whether this really represents a change in the depth to transition zone, or it simply represents the effect of the negative buoyancy and that the discontinuity acts as a membrane. So this is probably something that we can here talk about. I don't have a very clear opinion on this subject. I will demonstrate it, one or two slides from now. I'm sorry? Well, it's sort of, I mean, essentially you have a boundary in a fluid, and if you put some heavy weight, it would deflect downward. So it's not really a, you know, doesn't have very specific physical meaning. Essentially, it's sort of a boundary, and you put something on it, and it deflected down. You have already seen this figure. Anne showed it a few days ago. And what it shows is, again, a comparison of transition zone thickness. What's interesting, you already have seen that. You have seen that. And but this is different because this is using the converted phases. And it's somewhat, it used to be a controversial subject, but I think that now that these data agree, as I say, this is different kind of data. The tricky thing here was that there was only about 200 points to fill the whole world, but it so happens that it reproduces these maps, which were sampled with much more even distribution of points in a very similar way. So I think we probably should have a substantial confidence in the our knowledge of the large wavelength topography of the transition zone. So this is where Barbara anticipated this question, because you have velocity anomalies, the rays have to go through them, so you can essentially perhaps have some trade-offs between the velocity and boundary topography. So the solution is to solve for the whole thing at once, so that we essentially try to explain the data, including the all the data plus the measurements that are related to the boundary topography, the SS precursors, differential travel times of reflections from 400 and 670, and solve for the whole thing. So we have essentially a 3D velocity model, which is characterized by 5,068 parameters. That's 14 splines with 362 knots. The 400 for 400 kilometer topo, and 360 and 362. So we simultaneously solve for both data sets. One could say that probably a tricky thing is, you know, to this is much smaller data set than that characterizing the whole Earth and how you weight them. But we tried a series of weight, and as a result, there is a change, there is a trade-off. I'm sorry, before I get to this, let me just show that the overall power spectra, this is the topo, the model that included topography, very little change with respect to the previous model. There is also this flattening of velocities, but they essentially red and black curve follow each other. They're extremely well correlated with each other, not so well with the earlier model S12, which is sort of 12 years old now or more. Now, if we perform the separate inversion for 410 and 660 discontinuities, we obtain this result. When I say separate, we essentially correct the data for the known velocity model, in this particular case, the S362D1. And that's what we obtain. Now, when we form the joint inversion, the maps change somewhat. It's really the topography that's affected by it. As you could see from this cross-correlation, you couldn't tell the models in the sense of velocity perturbations apart. Essentially, velocity contrasts decrease at 410. If you thought that 410 was depressed, you wouldn't think that in the Pacific, that you wouldn't think that now. On the other hand, the anomalies strengthened for 660. So, and actually, for example, the degree two substantially increased. So these maps confirm that, there is certain amount of trade-off, the main characteristics, however, remain the same, and that the topography on 660 is very different from that on 400, and that essentially calculated correlation coefficient is zero. So they are really decorrelated. Whatever it is that if the long wavelengths topography on 410 has some significance other than being noise, it's very different from what happens at 660. So this idea of some very broad mantle flow where the flow crosses both 400 and 660 kilometers, where you would expect that they would be anti-correlated, they are decorrelated. So, that's the difference. This is the separate inversion where we only where we correct for velocities, and then invert the precursor data for topography. And this is when we solve for the model using some starting model, using both all the big data set with waveforms, travel times, and other things, plus the data from the precursors. So there is some difference, and in a sense, I guess, but the difference is not in the velocity structure. The velocity structures are just about the same. So in some sense, the topography measurements are a little bit more sensitive to variations, and this is where you would expect that the trade-off would occur, the travel times of precursors are about 20 times more sensitive to the change in the radius of discontinuity than transmitted waves. So the transmitted waves have certain nominal sensitivity to a change in the depth of discontinuity, but it's very small, because essentially you have a change in velocity only by 5%. In case of reflection, you essentially have a two-way path, and the entire, you don't have a difference between velocities, but the entire velocity jump. So, for example, 1 kilometer change in 660 would give you about 0.4 second time change, while transmitted waves through the same 5% discontinuity would give you only something like 0.05 seconds. So that's a very large difference. Now we can make some cross sections where we show jointly the velocities and topography. And here is the cross section A, which goes sort of through Isle-Bonin. And you see this wide range of elevated velocities. These are earthquakes. But you also, what you see is depressed boundary. Okay, and well, even 400 here seems to be a little bit depressed, but it's very wide and depressed. The same in case of cross-section B, which is across the Marianas, very far, don't know how far that goes. Notice that this is like 30 degrees minimum, the width of this, so it's 3,000 kilometers, and the same thing here. So the black lines, the actual shape of the discontinuity increased by a factor of 3 so that you would actually see things. And so what we have depressions of discontinuity associated with these very wide velocity anomalies. Things look a little bit different in different places. So here we have Japan. We still have somewhat broad anomaly. Here we have actually quite a bit, though the upper mantle is fast under Asia here. But we have a fairly substantial depression of the discontinuity, and the same thing in case of the cross-section B. If we go to Tonga, we actually see something quite different. There's relatively little velocity anomaly in the transition zone, and fairly large velocity anomaly going down to some 1,400 kilometers actually below transition zone. And this particular place I will show later is a place where we think that the avalanche process may be going on, or it's not we, but one paper suggested it. There was a study in 2001 by Fukao et al., which essentially using tomography deduced what happens to the slabs. So this is, it shows, there is a key here that essentially most of the slabs, or great many of them, stop at 660. Some of them penetrate a little bit, say down to 800, but that may be question of resolution. There are some, such as, well, noted here as Kermadec, that actually go down to 1,400 kilometers. The only slabs that appear to go deep into the lower mantle are the two inactive subduction zones. One is the Farallon, and the other one is India, or I guess Thetis subduction zone. So there is evidence that the now the difference between this study is that this was a local study focusing on a particular subduction zones. What we did was the global solution, because this doesn't tell you what happens in between subduction zones, whether you have some velocity anomalies, how the system behaves in other places than just subduction zones. So the two studies generally tend to confirm each other. I think that some of this here is probably just poorer resolution, so that it's not really clear that these go this extra 150 kilometers or so. These are These are fairly distinct. That's based on several tomographic studies. They essentially compared three or four different models and essentially demonstrated that even though the resolution of this model was different, that similar structure existed in all of them. I guess they took there to determine the depth eventually. I guess they used their higher resolution study as a measure, but they did fairly wide comparison of other results. So how to reconcile or how to explain what we see that it's happening to 600 at 660 discontinuity? And one convection study I'm not saying that study is right, it just produces a similar effect, and that's the one of Takri et al., followed by a more detailed paper in 94, where he calculates this is the low temperature anomalies, these are high temperature anomalies. The low temperature anomalies show this characteristic thing where the material in this model, there's 660 kilometers discontinuities included as a endothermic phase transformation, and it impedes the flow of the material. A certain amount of material must gather and have sufficient overall negative buoyancy to break through this barrier, and then it does it very fairly fast, and when it comes down it splatters along the core-mantle boundary. And this behavior has a particular expression in the power spectrum. This is angular order number, this is depth. So as a function of depth, it's not particularly good graphics, but essentially what this shows is that there is a lot of power in low degrees in the upper mantle. This is the discontinuity. It changes suddenly into a more white spectrum, and then it again, because of these splattering things, becomes red at the bottom. And here they actually compared it with the one of the Harvard models that was available at this time, and again you have the large concentration of long wavelengths anomalies here just above the discontinuity, whitening of the spectrum, and then again increase. And so in a sense, the Takri's model, where there is a temporary barrier at 660, does explain sort of major radio features that are observed in tomographic models. It's an old model. I guess it still would be considered somewhat primitive in today's standard. I was talking with Peter, and he essentially said that the issue should be revisited. The problem is that the current observations indicate much lower Clapeyron slope for the 660 transformation, and therefore it would not be as strong a barrier. But there must be some other factor, and I'm not sure what it is, that essentially leads to the equivalent result. And so the thing that is robust today, after all these studies, is that indeed there is a major impediment in flow across the 660 kilometers, and that seems to be the only place where this distinction is, the only depth at which we find such a change in behavior. At other depths, there may be some other discontinuities, like 400, but they don't really seem to impede the continuity of velocity anomalies, presumably either thermal or compositional. Now, this thing that I told you about the currently ongoing avalanche. This is actually tomography model of Van der Hulst. That's a regional model, that's not from his. And here you see this big sort of root that sits below the 660 kilometer discontinuity. You saw it in our models, but essentially Van der Hulst model shows the same thing. And Piskrowicz, Mitrovica, and Ishii decided to model it. In addition to, well, I'm going to show this model, and I really don't know that much about it. The Tonga region is region very complex. Seismicity here, Wai-Ping Chen wrote this paper in Science in 2001. This is essentially from distribution of seismicity. It looks like it's sort of torn away part of the slab. This is the slab that I mentioned, just horizontally laying, not quite dead slab. And here there are some additional velocity anomalies, but basically this is the seismicity and what we know about the slab distribution from that in the upper mantle. So what they did is they essentially put a flat slab on the bottom, and at some point it broke through, it initiated its own flow, and then fell to the depth of 400 kilometers. And as a result of this induced flow, it rearranged the tectonics of the Fiji Plateau, Tonga, Vanuatu region. So this is unfortunately only a two-dimensional calculation, but it does reproduce major features. So it actually could be that there is an avalanche going on as we speak, although I guess in advanced stages. The other place that has certain similarity in terms of the depth of the anomaly under the 660 is the Indonesian region, and it might be really worth looking at whether there are some similarities. Now, I started with these cross sections, very effective cross sections, or very impressive cross sections through the Farallon slab. Here we make a little bit wider cross sections through six different seismic models, including that of Grant. And here is where you see the Farallon slab. Here are these other anomalies in his model. But you can actually see that even in this model, there is something here, some 3,000 kilometers to the west, that obviously doesn't have anything to do with this. Now, this is Caltech model. This is pretty big structure here. This is Berkeley model. There is a pretty big structure. This is Scripps. This is our model. And so the question is whether this, what looks like Farallon plate, is actually part of some much larger scale process, which we still don't understand, because we didn't have any recent subduction, and it's difficult to explain these features by presence of the subducted slabs. A very similar thing happens on the other side of the Pacific. This is cross-section now through Asia. And this is the region which I think Louise showed, that there were sort of two slabs, and Van der Woel wanted to have a Jurassic slab present. What it actually shows is that if this is the present-day slab, you have another feature which is very large, and it's present in pretty much all the models, other than Grant's model is generally very weak in this particular area, and he has anomalies only at the bottom. So again, there's this possibility of existing some very large scale structures in a lower mantle that don't have obvious relation to the present day tectonics. This is some 15-year-old model which shows the Great African Plume. This is at the depth of 2,800 kilometers in the mantle, and some connections have been made with respect to the plate tectonic history. you have this huge East Equatorial Pacific plume group. You have equally large but differently oriented Great African plume. Then you have some spotty anomalies, but they generally arrange themselves into ring or fast velocities around Pacific. So this sort of gives an impression that there is some, but not clear what, connection to the tectonics as observed on the surface or within the upper mantle. The further connection is that through distribution of hotspots, and this is again at 2750 kilometer depth. This is the velocity model. The red is slow and presumably hot. And these are hotspots. There's many maps of hotspots, of distribution of hotspots, and 95% of them are within the red region. So the indication is that somehow this distribution of velocities near Coromantu boundary correlates well with the distribution of hotspots in the at the Earth's surface. Now, Barbara showed you this picture. I guess it was actually in color. This is black and white. Of the six blind men that constructed an elephant, and each of them essentially was touching, since they were blind, a different part of the elephant, and not realized how big an animal it is, came with a very different descriptions. The ears were fans, the trunk was a spear, the trunk was a snake, and so forth, and tail was a rope. And they argued then very strongly that each of them was right. So I guess we have to gather, we run this danger, and it's not really that, it's a real thing. You have a cross-section here. This is cover of the recent GSA special paper. And this is one view of the mantle, and this is another. This is the anti-plume view. And if you look at the details, and I don't have time to go into it, they are very different. And yet, I mean, we all have the same information, but obviously we use it differently. And I think that the concept of CIDR, of this type of meetings, and perhaps establishing institute would somehow help us to organize and correlate our information. So with this hopeful statement, I finish. Thank you. Yes. I didn't really look at PP. The SS was very useful simply because it's such a strong contrast. But there was a paper by Kim's group on that subject several 5 or 6 years ago. And other people, including Peter Scheer on one hand and the Cambridge-Oxford group, essentially observed PP, and they did not come to the same conclusion. It's sort of a mystery. I really don't have a good answer. But as you could see, well, whoever spoke about the velocity contrast, there still seems to be a fairly large difference between the assessment of the velocity jumps at different discontinuities, both in P and S. I think it was Tom. Compare the study by Scheer and Flanagan with that by the Oxford group, Chambers, I think, and Woodhouse. Well, there is more recent paper, I think, by the Oxford group, which now sees occasionally split of the 660 reflections. I'm not sure But they also see it in PP, or maybe especially in PP. However, they also had seen before the 520 split into two discontinuities, and it's a very elusive. It's sort of you get, if you want to resolve these narrower discontinuities more closely spaced, you essentially enter, unfortunately, in the noise region, because you have to go to higher frequency, noise is higher, and it's relatively easy to get some split. These were all S models, that, except for the model of van der Hughes that I was showing. The S is easier to map, partly because the variations are larger, and part of it is, I guess, that it's more sensitive to certain things like composition and even temperature. I didn't get into this, but there are some models that simultaneously derive P and S velocity, or bulk sound modulus and shear modulus, or bulk sound velocity and shear velocity. And there are some fairly peculiar results, such as anti-correlation in the Lorentz mantle of the perturbations in bulk sound velocity and shear velocity, which seem to be laterally varying, implying that actually there must be changes in composition, because it couldn't be explained. The variations of this anti, or sometimes it's a positive correlation, could not be explained by variations in temperature, because so it has to include the variations in composition. But generally, P, we have more data because of sources such as the ISC bulletins, where I guess if you really counted all the P's, you could have probably 20 million data or more. On the other hand, the data are noisy, and basically only teleseismic data can be depended on. So in some of the studies that did both P and S, such as one at Harvard and one at Scripps, and I guess there must have been some other ones, we tried to combine the ISC data. We at Harvard now tried to combine ISC data also with some surface wave data which have certain sensitivity to P. So we actually obtained also perturbations in the upper mantle, and for example, in transition zone, the correlation is positive between bulk sound velocity and shear velocity. So these things do change with radius, and they may represent very different things. Alan. Well, I mean, it's possible. I think I may have some slides somewhere, I guess, if I go to the sort mode. There's a few additional slides. Let's see, this is the elephant poem, which I spared you. And show. Well, anyway, let me. So this is average thickness of calculated under continents and major oceanic basins. And in general, the thickness, if you look at the continents, is larger under continents. It's actually 8 kilometers and 10 kilometers for North America and Asia. 4 kilometers South America. So generally, the continents have a thicker transition zone. Oceans have thinner transition zone. There are exceptions. And one exception is Antarctica, which I wouldn't worry too much about because there's not too many data points there. But it's South Atlantic. And South Atlantic has it could be very interesting to look if there is any signature in the plumes that come through the South Atlantic transition zone, because there are these positive velocity anomalies, and actually the positive perturbation in the thickness of the discontinuity, which seems to be the stuff that sort of spilled out from the, you know, Pangaea times, and remained there. So the plumes, if they come from either lower mantle or 670 discontinuity, could be contaminated by some stuff that has been subducted in the past. I mean, this is of course a speculation, but in that sense it's sort of peculiar region, because this is oceanic region where you have these accumulated slabs, and there's quite a few hotspots around there. So I would expect that if the whole thing is right, that there could be some signature of the stuff there. Well, what I'm saying is, I we made this map, but we really it seems that if you look at the details, the better association between geography is that you have positive velocities where there are subducted slabs, and because it has to add to zero, you have negative, I mean not velocities but thickness, and you have a negative ones because the whole thing, everywhere else, because it has to add to zero. There is some indication that Pacific actually is, it's not completely even, so that the Pacific and I guess Indian Ocean have a little bit thinner zone. So there is sort of a marginal. If somebody wanted to make a case, which I guess Gosler and Kind once made, is that it does appear that it could be that, whether it's continent or ocean, does affect somehow a transition zone. But on the other hand, it's a relatively small sample, because we have these two large regions of subduction, Western Pacific and South America, so it's two, and they happen to be subducted, and most of the material seems to be on the continent. So, I don't think so, because the transition zone thickness is also established by the measurement of precursors reflected from 660 and 400. So these waves actually never see the crust. So that wouldn't be, in that sense, it wouldn't be related to crustal corrections. Some crustal corrections are very complicated, but in this case they were not necessary. No, we didn't. But it obviously can be done. Lev.
So I think there is some problem with the relation between low velocity and the lower mass hotspots. For example, you have huge area in Asia with a high velocity and the lower mass without hotspots. But in fact, there are hotspots. For example, there are huge volcanic plumes in Mongolia.
Well,
this is not included in the mix, so
This is a pretty old, like 25-year-old map of hotspots, and it's really association. It could be that, you know, there are very different maps of hotspots, and Stan probably, and maybe other people here, know more about it than I. But there's a sort of debate. So, for example, there's one of these split images, which I guess I can try to find. This one. So this paper, which is this half of the figure, is from Curtillo et al., for example, has distinguishes between three different kinds of plumes. There are plumes that come all the way from Corman to boundary. There are plumes that are generated by these very large super plumes, or whatever they are, and they spawn little plumes at the core, at the 670 kilometer discontinuity. And then there are some plumes that are related only to the surface tectonics. And I really, at the time when I prepared, this is a very old slide, I guess, we didn't know yet about these Asian plumes, but I don't know whether in, you know, category of plumes they really look like stuff that might have come from Corman to boundary or not. And it's going to be a... No, it actually shouldn't be that far, because it's there. Well, yeah, you can. Oh, that there was a study that indicated that plumes happen more at the edges of the anomalies than the slow anomalies and the interior. And I guess, well, sort of a statistical thing, but there were still plumes that were happening in the middle of the slow region. So it wasn't sort of absolute discriminant. But it's true that some of these things happen, you know, on the edges or close to the edges. And maybe it's even in this case is statistically significant. It's sort of a very ancient mid 80s or maybe even earlier collection of plumes that I forget now who assembled these. So I obviously this should be updated and has been, in a sense that there have been some more recent study or fairly recent studies on that subject. And so this is just a notion that, you know, there appears to be some connection between the Corman to boundary and the surface, which, in view of these results from the 670 and or the transition zone structure, we really have to understand it, because it's clearly a boundary that would tend to impede the transport. Not absolutely, obviously, but significantly. Tom. Well, because they...
Is that a minority opinion, or do you think that there's a consensus? Is there a change in the community, or is it very much a minority opinion, or
is it... Well, no, you're not. I guess this is why I showed these penetrating slabs so early on, is that seems to have formed the opinion, I guess, on this subject, and hopefully, you know. But then you had Peter say that his impression was that the pendulum is beginning to swing the other way. And I think that, you know, as the demographic models get better, And in particular, all the models that had these data sets that are critical to resolving things in a transition zone and below it, that is models like Berkeley, Scripps, Harvard, Oxford, Caltech, they all have this feature, which I was trying to show by the steepness of the cross-correlation auto-radio correlation function. So it's there, but it hasn't really been emphasized. And I guess it's a study in psychology of community. I'm fairly, you know, I may be minority opinion, but I think that it's a robust result, which has consequences that, that people sort of didn't so far choose to address. Well, let's see. It may take a while to get to that, but well, that's these are the ones that I like better, I guess. But it's a relatively low resolution model. We don't resolve things that are in size larger or smaller than 1,000 kilometers. So some of it is essentially the fuzziness of the model. So, for example, you know, the continuation of this fast thing on this side is real or is it sort of smearing effect? It's difficult to tell. The earthquakes. So, for example, the Benioff zone is not always very well resolved, although I guess here is some indication that the fastest velocities are where the cross section is, and pretty much the same in case of Izubonin. So maybe you can, in having this, what was it that you were? Well, the offset is significant in the sense that it essentially seems to be generally in a direction in which, if you can tell the difference, the slab is subducted, I guess. Or in case of retreating trench, as these are, it could be just laid down. So there is asymmetry with respect to the two sides of the Benioff zone. So in that sense, I guess the offset that there is more blue on the left, I guess, than on the right is significant. So it's not really, you know, it's not sort of pile that you collect, but it does have a certain orientation attached to it. Part of it is that, yes, that we don't always resolve this region. There is a lot of, well, there is a subduction zone, and then there is a lot of hot stuff associated with Lau Basin and so forth. So they essentially, when you have a contrast like this, you sometimes one side wins. So in that case, I guess, seems like, we didn't resolve the high velocities in a transition zone or upper mantle for that matter. You can see how much red there is. On the other hand, I think that this blue blob below the discontinuity is reasonably well resolved in most of the models, including some regional study of Vanderhills. So on the other hand, you know, there's offset, there's a little bit of offset here, because where there are high velocities and earthquakes, and that I would say is just a question of resolution. Again, these earthquakes are the boundary between two extremely different regions. So it's essentially, I think, that whichever is stronger in absolute terms wins. Please. Yeah, the 660 at Tonga is well, it's a little depressed here, I guess. But remember that this is this region where for which I showed this simulation of the avalanche, I guess. So that would be generally pretty atypical, I guess, because obviously things are still in a state of flux, if that's true. And certainly this anomaly is it ends just below this cutoff line. So it doesn't go much deeper into the lower mantle. So it really does look like somehow the high velocity material here has been drained from the transition zone. Yeah. No, I think it's robust. That, you know, the only two things that seem to go all the way to the core mantle boundary, although at least in their classification, is that that seems to be real. It's sort of confirmed by all the some four, I think, different tomographic models that they used. Although the cross section for the Eastern Asia does seem to indicate that there are some fast velocity going all the way to the core mantle boundary. But certainly the core mantle boundary region is very fast there. So how the two things have connected is not clear. But I think that the Fukao study is very careful, and I would, it's in a 2001 reviews of geophysics and space physics, and those of you that are interested in this subject, I very strongly recommend looking at it, because it essentially on its own weight in some way of the weight of the evidence and the numbers of the subduction slabs that zones that they looked at. Certainly this idea of trapping slabs, and I don't quite remember what was the explanation for some slabs going down to 1,000 kilometers, but not further. There was, but it's really the you know, everybody looks at this one cross section, yes, and say, well, you know, they really go down. And then even that cross section has, you know, the questions, because there are some other things that are not related or cannot be related to slab subduction. Of course, you can, you know, always say, well, explain some of it, so the glass is half full or half empty, but actually, sometimes if you really cannot explain half of the things, you may wonder whether you're understanding the whole process.